Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. My guest now is the filmmaker Werner Herzog. He's made 57 movies, including the fiction films Aguirre, the Wrath of God, Fitzcarraldo, Nosferatu, and Rescue Dawn, and documentaries like Little Dieter Needs to Fly, Grizzly Man, Cave of Forgotten Dreams, and now Into the Abyss, A Tale of Death, A Tale of Life. This most recent documentary is about the death penalty and fallout from a triple homicide case in Conroe, Texas, and the convicted murderers Michael Perry, who's on death row, and Jason Burkett serving a 40-year sentence. Here's a clip from the film of Michael Perry 8 days before his execution.
I literally forget, and then I look at my calendar, I'll hear someone say something, I'm like, man, and I'll sit back and I'll just stare at the wall and I'll be like, man, 8 days, 7 days, 6 days, or whatever, and it's like, it's just, I must not be comprehending the fact that it's that close, because, you know, it's hard for me to say, you know what, like I talked about, you know, in 8 days, these people want to murder me, and it's just something that it's hard for me to, believe that the state of Texas wants to murder me in 8 days.
That's a clip from the new Werner Herzog film, Into the Abyss. We'll talk about it now with the director and also about Herzog's huge body of work and what, if anything, his films have in common. Werner Herzog, welcome back to WNYC. It's a real pleasure to have you in our studio.
Thank you very much for having me.
So Michael Perry and Jason Burkett were convicted of murdering three people in their attempt to steal a car. It's a totally senseless crime that lands Perry on death row and Burkett with a very long prison sentence. You are unequivocally opposed to the death penalty. Is this a political film?
No, not really. Well, marginally, yes. But I declare myself, I, the filmmaker, am not in favor of capital punishment, and I respectfully disagree with the practice in the United States or in any other country, China, India, Russia, Japan, Pakistan, you just name it. So it's a form of criminal justice I cannot agree with, because as a German coming from a country which had a genocide and euthanasia and capital punishment in excess, I simply cannot be an advocate.
So you can draw a line from the Nazis and their genocidal crimes to a sense of justice where somebody has been a murderer is put to death.
Well, it's hard to debate it. I don't even have a real argument when I point back to the historical situation of Nazi Germany. That's not an argument. It's just a story. And you see, I would be the last one as a guest in your country to tell Americans or tell Chinese or tell other countries how to do things. No, I can't do that. But, of course, I think it's a question of principle, and a human being should not be executed. A state should not be in capacity to kill off anyone for any reason, except warfare.
Why did you choose Michael Perry and Jason Burkett out of all possible death penalty stories to tell in your film?
Well, the crime itself was so extraordinarily senseless. The whole thing looks like a big tapestry, like a big American Gothic or a real strange, abysmal story. But wherever you look, when you look at the perpetrators, when you look at the families of victims, when you look at bystanders, so to speak, or when you look at the executioner who has done 125 executions and all of a sudden has to quit, he can't continue. Wherever you look, there's another abyss.
You also interview, however, the sister and daughter of the victims, who says that she was glad she saw the execution, that her heart was not as heavy afterwards. So does the death penalty have some redeeming value, in your view?
Apparently for her, yes. However, right after that, I have a brief argument, and I ask her, would life in prison without the possibility of parole satisfy you? And she says yes. And I think this is a good attitude.
The film is heartbreaking. And I think the most powerful part comes during your interview with Jason Burkett's father, who's also incarcerated. And you asked him about his testimony during the trial when he asked the jury not to give his son the death penalty. And here is about a minute of his answer.
I asked the jury to, you know, please, you know, don't kill my son. I asked, just please don't kill my son. They never had a chance. He didn't have a father. I told him that, you know, I was never there. And his mother was you know, a single mother with four children. And she had handicaps. She's on disability. Most of that time she was living on disability. And so they really didn't, they lived off food stamps and, you know, HUD housing and that type of thing. And he really had a real poor life growing up. I just asked him not to kill my son. It wasn't his fault. I wish that I could take the time, his time. I wish I could, because I feel like it's my fault. I really do. I feel like I'm as much at fault as he is.
Another excerpt from Werner Herzog's new documentary, Into the Abyss, A Tale of Death, A Tale of Life. And that is a heartbreaking clip. The father who claims that, you know, his son is, in a sense, a victim of his being absent when he was growing up, somehow leading to his committing a murder.
What is also significant is that whenever you speak to inmates who are doing serious time or to death row inmates, and you ask them about how should we conduct our lives, what values should we look after, how should we raise our children, it's very, very astonishing that it always comes back to small family values. Very significant, and listening to them all of a sudden gives a message an enormous weight. How do we deal with our children? How do we protect them? How do we listen to them? How much are we present in their lives? And it's just very, very compelling how they speak about family values.
It's almost an unresolvable eternal question, because individual families always exist in the context of social pressures that create who they are. On the other hand, regardless of the social pressures, we have to look at our individual responsibilities.
Yes, of course, and there's such a thing as a natural law out there, as much as we have written law, and natural law dictates You have to love your children, no matter if they are going astray, no matter whether they do something wrong. Stick to them, protect them, support them.
So on your body of work, and in particular your nonfiction documentary films, how do you pick your subject matter? Like, for example, you were given access to the Kuwait oil fields after the first Gulf War to make a documentary in the 90s, a film that could have been political, and instead you made not a documentary, an apocalyptic sci-fi film called Lessons of Darkness, in which the landscape is really unrecognizable as Earth. This seems like maybe a very Herzogian choice. So what are your guiding principles when you make a choice like that?
Well, talking about the fires of all these oil wells in Kuwait, 720 or so, you saw it every single day on the news. Of course it was a political issue. Of course it was a big crime. But when you arrived in Kuwait and you saw this damage, in 60 minutes of film, you have not a single shot where you can recognize our planet again. It's as if it was alien, as if it was a different star. And I decided this is much bigger. It's much bigger than just a political film. It's a film about of cosmic dimensions, almost like a science fiction film, because it was of course a political crime, but more so a crime against creation itself.
Do you require sometimes that the filming is virtually impossible to do, like underneath the ice in Antarctica, which you've done in an ancient cave in France, or in a Kuwaiti oil field, or, you know, the ship over the mountain in Fitzcarraldo?
Well, you have to do your job. I'm a professional, and I remember in Kuwait, it was sometimes so hot, 1,400 degrees Celsius near these flames. Our microphone melted away. Our soles of our shoes melted away, and you really had to take cover quickly when it came to that. Or moving a ship over a mountain, yes, let's face it, I think every grown-up man once in his life should move a ship over a mountain.
The hero's quest, is that what it is?
Not really, no. It's just we should be prepared to live our dreams.
Ben in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Werner Herzog. Hello, Ben.
Hello, thanks for taking my call. I'm a huge fan. I find all your movies thoroughly enjoyable.
Thank you.
I always come away from watching them just kind of happier and in a better mood than I was before. And I think a lot of that is due to, as you mentioned, Brian, the highly idiosyncratic narration. And I wonder how much of that is kind of planned and really conscious in Mr. Herzog's approach to movie making.
Thank you. And let me give, for people who may not be familiar, an audio example. This is a clip of Werner Herzog's voiceover from the documentary Encounters at the End of the World, 22 seconds.
Under the ice, the divers find themselves in a separate reality where space and time acquire a strange new dimension. Those few who have experienced the world under the frozen sky often speak of it as going down into the cathedral.
So that was from the Antarctica film that we were referring to before.
Well, and the choice was obvious. There should be my commentary, or in Grizzly Man, for example. Although Timothy Treadwell, the protagonist of the film, was already dead for 10 months. He was killed and eaten by a bear together with his girlfriend. And I do have an ongoing argument because he sees wild nature as something like vanilla ice cream, emotional, and the bears all fluffy little creatures that he has to protect. And I stop and I say, well, here I differ with Treadwell. My opinion is different. But the form of how I do it comes through the subject. Into the Abyss has no commentary. And you see, when you are facing a man on death row and you have 50 minutes with him, you just don't appear in frame. It just would be wrong. It felt wrong. You hear my voice from behind the camera engaging in conversation, but I think it was the right choice. So it comes with the subject.
So you broke with your iconic style. Your critics say, you know, stop inserting yourself so explicitly like that. Better for a documentarian to use more cinema verite, where the director stays out of it and lets the characters tell the story.
Well, yeah, you can hear it even more exacerbated by telling you, yeah, you should be just like a fly on the wall, unobtrusive, invisible. No, we should be the hornets that sting, that engage. We are storytellers. I'm a director. I have to do my job. And I don't want to be the camera in the security camera in a shopping mall.
Do you know YouTube enough to know that your voice has become an internet meme, that there are videos online of people mocking your narrations?
And imposters, yes. I think there's at least a dozen imposters. I welcome them all as if they were my secret bodyguards. But, of course, I have been on The Simpsons Show, and I will be as an actor now in a Hollywood film with Tom Cruise in December. So, in a way, my voice or my being an actor as well has caught on. I've been in quite a few films, and I'm always good when I play a vile or debased, dysfunctional villain, or when I have to be dangerous. I'm always good at that.
People talk about method acting.
Oh,
maybe
no,
you're
not for
like,
me.
Like a method director.
No, I'm not a method director either. I don't know how I direct, but I have developed my tools. I have developed my way to do the films, and I think the results are fairly decent.
I guess I'm thinking again of Fitzcarraldo and the others, where you have to go to such extremes to make the film. So is it more than just a film for you? Are you out for some kind of other experience?
No, my experience doesn't count at all. You see, the only thing that counts is what does an audience see on a screen at the end of the day. That's the only thing that counts. And I'm not into the business of self, whatever, scrutiny and finding my boundaries. It's just not what I'm after.
In the film Rescue Dawn, which featured Christian Bale and was based on the documentary you made called Little Dieter Needs to Fly, you were really roughing it in the jungle. Your wife Lena told The New Yorker that the way you cleaned your muddy clothes there was that you just walked into the shower fully clothed. That was a great detail revealed in that article. So confirming the notion that you're kind of an eccentric guy, which is maybe why there are 10 documentaries made about you. Can you tell us what the 58th film will be about?
Well, I'm working on a mini-series for television called It's a Death Row Project, and it's 52-minute long films on death row inmates. Then I will be acting in a movie, and I have a feature film project. So it's going on and on. I don't stop easily.
And what do you think when people make these features about you and portray you as this eccentric guy?
Well, let them do it, because they're all wrong. I think I'm dead center. And they all look bizarre when I look at what you see on television, for example, whatever, Jerry Springer show, WrestleMania, or it's just what is popular on television. They are the eccentrics. I make sense. I'm the center.
Does your body of work add up to something that you can articulate as a central point?
Very hard to make a judgment myself. However, I do believe that I have a long-range vision, and I've never lost it out of sight. This is why people who see 120 seconds of a movie immediately can tell this must be Herzog's. How this functions and why it is like that, I don't know.
The director, Werner Herzog, his latest film is Into the Abyss. Thank you so much. It's an honor to have you in the studio.
Thank you very much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.